Good afternoon. Today I am going to describe briefly an event which some of you may not have heard about. The Cooper Street Draft Riot, which took place in Boston on July the 14th and 15th, 1863. In the spring of 1863, the third year of the war between the states, the Union on Northern cause wasn't going too well, and Congress and the President were plainly worried. We had enough men and money up here in the North, but the Confederacy had the generals. Fearing that the South might win, Congress gave unlimited power to President Abraham Lincoln, who wasn't as universally loved and respected then as he is today. Lincoln issued a call for volunteers, but he didn't get them. So Congress offered a bonus of $100 to each man who would volunteer. By the time the war had ended, that generous but rash proposition had cost the country over $500 million. And it brought to the recruiting offices the worst possible type of men. Illiterate, unscrupulous bums who played the game for all it was worth. They'd enlist in one place and collect and then skip to another section, sign up and collect again. And they kept up this cowardly business of bounty jumping till the law finally caught up with them. Some states, including Massachusetts, offered as much as $1,000. But even that did not produce the army President Lincoln wanted. So he finally called for 300,000 men to be drafted by individual states. Speaking editorially, the New York Evening Post said, "We are coming, Father Abraham, 300,000 more, from Mississippi's winding streams and from New England's shore." But the men didn't come. Investigation showed that states hadn't taken the draft seriously. So in desperation, Congress passed the detested conscription law, which for the first time in the nation's history operated directly on the people through legal machinery set up by the federal government. It caused nationwide criticism and controversy, and in some places, open revolt and bloodshed. In Indiana, two provost marshals in charge of enrolling were beaten to death. In Ohio, the draft office was wrecked, books and records burned, and the clerks beaten up. Up in Vermont, workers at a marble quarry said, "If any government snooper comes around here to take down names, he'll get a load of buckshot." And so it went, all over New England, New Jersey, New York, and the Middle West. Now here's how they worked that conscription business. Local provost marshals went around and took down names of all male citizens between the ages of 18 and 45. Later, when the names were drawn, all men between 18 and 35 and all unmarried men between 35 and 45 were called for duty at once. The married men between 35 and 45 were told to stand by. Exceptions, for obvious reasons, were gunsmiths, foundry workers, and chemists. School teachers were exempted from the draft if they had 20 or more pupils. And overnight, new schools sprang up like mushrooms, some offering free tuition. And you can draw your own conclusions. And oh yes, any draftee who could afford to pay the government $300 for a substitute to go fight in his place was also exempt. And this, the poor people claimed, gave the rich man's son a decided advantage. The quota for Massachusetts was 18,000, of which Boston was to furnish 3,500. The canvas for names began around the last of June, and by July the 8th, it was finished. Drafting in Boston began soon after. Slips of paper bearing the name and address of each man were placed in a drum or revolving box and shaken up. They used a goldfish bowl in World War I to draw my number, but I had already enlisted in the Navy. Well, a blindfolded person then reached into the drum and took out a slip. As the name was read, it was recorded, posted on the bulletin boards, and of course the newspapers carried complete lists. But in some sections of the city, provost marshals were sent to the homes of the draftees to inform them their names had been drawn. The draft in New York City in 1863 had started earlier and ended with terrible consequences. Vast mobs roamed the streets, attacking women and trampling children. Stores were ransacked, warehouses burned. There were wholesale, unprovoked killings. And while I've never been able to find an official record of the New York casualties, I can quote the World Almanac, which states, "As a result of the draft riots in New York City alone, 1,000 persons lost their lives." Here in Boston, there was no evidence that such frightful violence was about to take place. But there was a great deal of opposition to the government's method of raising an army by conscription. Many a prominent and proper Bostonian said, "This law is unjust, illegal, and oppressive." I have always remembered the mottoes which my English teacher, Anna E. Coughlin, put on the blackboard each morning at high school. And one of them was, "A mob is a monster, with heads enough but no brains." And it was just such a brainless mob that started the Cooper Street draft riot 88 years ago yesterday. The provost marshals had gone to a house on Prince Street in Boston's North End to inform a man he'd been drawn for military service. As they stood on the steps, they were attacked by an infuriated woman who screamed that nobody was going to drag her husband off to war. She struck one officer over the head with a broomstick and attacked the other with a hatchet. Her screams for help brought a lot of other wild women, and instantly the whole neighborhood was in an uproar. A sober-minded storekeeper tried to explain, but he was knocked down and trampled. And when the badly injured officials escaped through a store at Endicott and Charlestown Streets, the crowd followed, completely wrecking the store and leaving the manager and clerk insensible behind the counter. From there, they went to other shops, smashing windows and taking anything they could lay hands on, all the while yelling, brandishing clubs, and tearing each other's clothes. They hadn't the slightest idea why they were acting that way, who they wanted to beat up, or what had caused the commotion in the first place. Surely a mob is a monster with heads enough but no brains. Naturally, the police arrived to restore order, and for the first time in Boston's history, they were jeered at and spat upon. Four of the officers were so badly beaten they were placed on the danger list, and one Boston policeman was so horribly injured by that mob, he never did another day's work. He remained a helpless cripple for more than 20 years. And all this, mind you, took place in less than 30 minutes. By mid-afternoon, the fanatical women got tired of fighting and went home to get supper. Their places being taken by teenage boys, loafers from the saloons, and roustabouts from the waterfront. After supper, the menfolks joined the throng, which jam-packed the narrow North End streets. Then suddenly, they all started for Station 1 on Hanover Street. As they approached the police station, waving clubs and cursing loudly, Deputy Chief Edward H. Savage went out on the steps to meet them. He knew many in that milling mob, and almost all of them knew him for the fine, friendly officer of the law he was. But when he tried to get their attention, they jeered, called him vile names, and tossed rotten eggs and apples. One man climbed up on a lamppost and shouted, "I don't mind fighting around here where I can go home to dinner, but no blankety-blank government agent is going to conscript me to go fight in snake-infested swamps down south." That remark was greeted with a great cheer. Realizing the seriousness of the situation, Chief Savage walked down the steps, and easing his way through the angry crowd, he started on foot for Station 2, up on Court Street. The mob, now numbering 2,000, closed in and followed him every step of the way. Deputy Savage saw that many had knives, and the bulges under their coats indicated other concealed weapons. Inside the police station, Mr. Savage found a serious-faced group of city officials. Word had just come over the wire that New York City was at the mercy of 100,000 hoodlums. Thousands had been injured, 500 were dead, and a final bulletin told of Horace Greeley being driven from his office in the Tribune building. The presses had been smashed, the type spilled, and the five-story structure set on fire. Boston's mayor, Honorable Frederick Walker Lincoln, jumped to his feet and said grimly, "Well, by heaven, nothing like that is going to happen here in Boston. Call out the troops. Send a boat down the harbor to Fort Warren. Tell them we're in desperate need of men and guns. Sound the riot call over the fire alarm. Ask for citizens to volunteer. From now on, by heaven, the city of Boston will be under martial law." Moments later, the dread sound of 11 blows on the fire alarm was repeated 3 times. And as the bells boomed over Boston, many a loyal citizen grabbed a gun or a club and rushed to save the city from the lawbreakers. The first organized group to arrive was the Governor's Guard, the First Corps of Cadets, followed by a battalion of cavalry and a small battery of artillery from Fort Warren. They landed around 7 p.m. and marched without music through Hanover to Salem Streets and on to the Cooper Street Armory. One company was already there, but when the mobsters saw the regulars, they let fly with tin cans, bottles, bricks, and cobblestones. One officer and 6 men were knocked down, but the troops kept right on. And when they reached the armory, they found it surrounded by several thousand ugly and grim-faced men. This mob had planned to seize the armory on Cooper Street and take over the guns and ammunition. Now they had to fall back on bricks and cobblestones. And would you believe it, children were ordered to pry the cobblestones loose from the street and fill up big baskets to be toted by the women, folks, and girls to where the male citizens could hurl the rocks at the uniformed police and United States soldiers. A white-faced captain shouted, "Fix bayonets and prepare to charge." And that caused the rioters to scatter. So the soldiers marched through and entered the armory. But they'd barely closed the door when a shower of cobblestones raked the roof and sides of the armory, and every pane of glass was smashed in less time than it takes to tell about it. Then somebody dragged up a heavy timber, and it was used as a battering ram to break down the door. But when the officers inside the armory heard that thundering noise, they wheeled up 2 field pieces and loaded them with grape shot. One gun faced the North Margin Street entrance, and the other was pointed at the Cooper Street door. Now the banging became louder, and the door began to crack. "Load and prepare to fire." But that order was countermanded when it was learned that an officer was trying to cross the street. Then he'd been struck down by the mob and was now being kicked without mercy. A man at a second-story window in the armory shouted, "They've killed him." And as he leaned out the window to see the officer's body being dragged through the gutter, a pistol shot rang out, and he fell dead to the floor. Then came more shots, and continued banging at the door. And as the hinges gave way and the door sagged partly open, the field piece sent a withering blast of mini-ball and grape through what was left of the door, showering the mobsters outside with splinters and shrapnel, and completely demolishing the front of a house across the street. Stopping only long enough to pick up their dead and drag away the wounded, the rioters retired for the time being. Later, they marched en masse to Dark Square, intending to break into Reed's gun store for rifles, cartridges, and gunpowder. But this time, they were met by Boston's finest, augmented by courageous and patriotic citizens. And after a few shots were exchanged, the battle was over. However, shortly after midnight, an alarm of fire brought the hand tubs and horse-drawn steamers clattering into Cooper Street. The mob had returned, and believing they might blow the soldiers to kingdom come, they threw blazing oil-soaked rags into the armory. If the powder magazine caught fire, hundreds might be killed. So the firemen sprang forward, only to have ladders yanked from under them, hose lines slashed, and one piece of kit was overturned and rendered useless. Somehow they got the fire out, and then turned the hose on the hot-headed rioters, who, realizing they couldn't take over the city of Boston, slunk away into the darkness. And thus ends a very brief account of the Cooper Street Draft Riot, which happened just 88 years ago, last night. Nothing like it was seen in Boston until 1919, when the police force went out on strike. I was in Boston that awful week, and I don't ever want to see such sights again. Maybe some of you will recall that it was a statement on that strike that brought Calvin Coolidge into national prominence. Governor Coolidge said,
"There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, at any time. We must have law and order and faith in Massachusetts."